I was actually just standing in front of the mirror this morning, brushing my teeth
Right.
and just kind of looking at my own reflection. And I had this really weird thought. We basically just assume our eyes are windows, right? Like perfectly clean, clear glass.
Yeah, that's the standard assumption.
Like the world is out there, I'm in here, and my eyes just let the light in. I hit record on my brain, and I get this perfect high definition copy of reality. It just feels totally intuitive.
It's the default setting for almost everyone, I mean, throughout history. In philosophy, we actually call that naive realism.
Naive realism.
Yeah, it's the idea that we're essentially just passive cameras, taking pictures of the universe. What you see is exactly what is actually out there.
Right. But then I started digging into this stack of research you sent over for today's deep dive, specifically this incredible lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes on Immanuel Kant.
Oh, yeah.
And I realized that assumption might be, well, it might be total garbage, or at least dangerously misleading.
Garbage might be a bit harsh, but Kant would definitely say it is fundamentally wrong.
He suggests our minds aren't cameras at all. They're more like cookie cutters, or those really weird tinted glasses that you literally can't take off.
That is the core idea, yeah. Kant argues that the shape of reality, the things we think are just fundamental facts of the universe, like time, space, cause, and effect.
The big stuff.
Exactly. He says they aren't necessarily coming from the world outside. They're coming from us. They are the mold that we pour the world into.
Which is just a totally trippy concept to wrap your head around, especially on a Tuesday.
It really is.
So today, for you listening at home, we are doing a massive deep dive into Immanuel Kant. We're focusing heavily on his critique of pure reason and the prolegomena.
Two of the most challenging texts in Western philosophy.
Challenging is a nice way to put it, but our mission today is pretty simple, even though the stakes are incredibly high. We are going to find out exactly how this guy managed to save science from total collapse.
And why he thinks you've never actually seen the real world in your entire life.
Yeah, it's what he called his Copernican Revolution.
Right, because just like Copernicus showed us the Earth isn't the center of the universe, Kant showed us that the object isn't the center of knowledge. The mind is.
But before we get to the really heavy philosophy, and there is definitely some heavy lifting today, we have to talk about the reputation of these books.
We do.
Because, I mean, light beach reading, this is not. I actually tried to read The Critique once in college, and I'm pretty sure I pulled a muscle in my brain.
You are definitely not alone there. Kant is notorious for being dense, difficult, and just incredibly dry.
Dr. Holmes shares this absolutely great little anecdote in the source lecture. It's about national stereotypes and book titles, and I think it sets the stage perfectly for the kind of mind we're dealing with today.
It's a classic academic joke, but it actually reveals a lot about Kant's approach.
So the premise goes like this.
Yeah.
You have this international competition. How would different nationalities write a book about elephants? So the Englishman submits his book first. It's titled Introduction to the Elephant.
Very proper, very decorous. Just the facts.
Exactly. Then the American submits his entry. It's called The Elephant Digest. Bigger and better.
Naturally.
Yeah.
Keep it snappy, make it profitable, and just move on.
The Frenchman. He writes The Love Life of the Elephant.
Prioritizing the important things in life, obviously.
Obviously. And then there is the German entry, Immanuel Kant.
Right. The German writes a massive three-volume work titled Prolegomena to the Study of the Elephant.
Which is just hilarious because prolegomena literally just means introduction.
Exactly. He hasn't even started talking about the elephant yet. He's written three giant volumes just to prepare you to start studying the elephant.
It sounds like he's just being completely difficult, or maybe a bit pretentious, honestly.
It does sound that way.
But as we go through the notes, you realize he didn't really have a choice, did he? He wasn't writing a massive intro just for the fun of it.
No, not at all. He was reacting to a massive existential crisis in philosophy.
The house was on fire.
Exactly. And this is the part people so often miss. They think Kant is just playing these obscure word games. He wasn't. He felt that the entire building of human knowledge was burning down.
He couldn't just write about the elephant or the world because he wasn't sure if we could actually know anything anymore.
Right. So let's paint the picture of this fire. Because to really understand his crazy solution, we have to understand the problem he was looking at.
What was the state of philosophy right before Kant stepped in?
You essentially had a battlefield, two entrenched camps who completely hated each other. On one side, you had the rationalists. We call them the dogmatic philosophers.
These are the castles in the sky guys.
In a way, yeah. Think of thinkers like Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz.
Okay.
They believed deeply in pure reason. They thought you could figure out the ultimate secrets of the universe, God, the soul, the laws of physics, just by sitting in a comfortable armchair and thinking hard enough.
So they start with a truth they think is just blatantly obvious, like Descartes with his, I think, therefore I am. And then they just use pure logic to build this massive tower of everything else on top of it.
Precisely. They built these intricate, gorgeous systems of metaphysics, axiomatic first principles. But they never really bothered to check the foundation against the messy real world. They just assumed their internal logic applied perfectly to the external universe.
Okay, so that's team logic. Who's on the other side of the battlefield?
The skeptics. The empiricists. And their undisputed heavyweight champion was a Scottish philosopher named David Hume.
Ah, Hume, the guy who basically dropped a nuclear bomb on philosophy.
He is the catalyst for everything we're talking about today. Dr. Holmes mentions that Kant famously said reading Hume awakened him from his dogmatic slumbers.
Which is just a really polite academic way of saying Hume absolutely panicked him.
It terrified him. Because Hume looked at how we understand the world, relying entirely on our senses, our experiences, and he realized something truly devastating about cause and effect.
Okay, let's drill into this. Because for you listening, this is the exact moment philosophy essentially broke. Hume argued that we don't actually see causes. Now, when I first read that in the notes, I thought, well, that's just ridiculous.
It feels wrong.
Yeah. If I go outside and kick a soccer ball, I see my foot hit it and I see the ball fly away. I caused that. I literally watched it happen.
Hume would stop you right there. He'd say, no, you didn't see a cause. You saw a sequence.
I saw a sequence.
Think of two billiard balls on a pool table. Ball A rolls over and hits ball B. Ball B moves.
Right.
Hume says, okay, what did your eyes actually see? You saw ball A move across the table.
Yes.
Then you saw them touch. A noise happened. Then you saw ball B move.
Okay.
You saw what he called constant conjunction. One thing constantly following another thing. But did you see the force? Did you visually see the necessary connection that physically commands ball B to move?
I mean, I don't see a little invisible rope pulling the ball. No, I don't see energy.
Exactly.
But I know it's there. I just infer it.
You assume it. You infer it. Hume argued that causality isn't something we experience with our senses at all. It's just a habit of the human mind. We expect B to follow A just because it always has in the past.
Like waking up and expecting the sun to be there.
Right. But we can't mathematically or logically prove it must happen the next time.
But wait, if we can't literally prove cause and effect, doesn't that mean we can't actually explain anything?
It means science collapses.
Wow.
Physics is entirely based on universal laws of cause and effect. If causality is just a mental habit, a psychological expectation, then gravity isn't a law.
It's just a coincidence that keeps happening.
Exactly. It's just something we're used to seeing. We can't actually prove the sun will rise tomorrow. We can't prove that applying heat will boil water next time.
So the empiricists effectively burned the house down. They prove that if you only trust your senses, you can't even know the basic laws of physics.
And if you can't do physics, you certainly cannot do metaphysics.
Right.
Proving God exists, proving the soul is immortal, forget about it. If you can't even rationally prove that a billiard ball moves because it was hit, you have absolutely zero hope of proving a first cause of the entire universe.
This is the crisis Kant wakes up to. He looks at the rationalists and realizes they're just dreaming in their armchairs, making stuff up.
Unchecked logic.
And he looks at the empiricists, like Hume, and realizes they've destroyed the very possibility of human knowledge.
Right. So Kant issues this massive challenge, and he was so intensely serious about this that he literally threatened to solemnly and legally suspend all metaphysicians from their jobs.
I just love that image. Just put down your quills. Nobody write another word of the meaning of life until we solve this Hume problem.
He effectively said, stop the presses. We need to go back to the drawing board and figure out if our brains even work the way we think they do. Any future metaphysics has to pass this test.
So to save their jobs, and honestly, his own, he had to build a totally new toolkit.
He did.
He had to find a way to agree with Hume that all knowledge starts with experience, but disagree with him that it ends there.
And this brings us to the jargon. Now, I know we usually try to keep things super accessible, but Dr. Holmes makes it very clear in the lecture that you really cannot understand Kant's breakthrough without understanding the specific tools he built.
It's like trying to understand computer coding without knowing what a zero and a one mean.
Exactly.
So let's break these terms down for everyone listening. It all comes down to two pairs of distinctions. Let's do pair number one.
Okay, pair number one is analytic versus synthetic judgments.
Analytic. Okay, that sounds like analyzing what is already there.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
An analytic statement is one where the answer, the predicate, is already packed inside the definition of the subject.
Okay, give me an example.
The classic philosophical example is, a bachelor is an unmarried male.
Right. So if I walk into a room at a party and you point to a guy and say, hey, that guy is a bachelor, I don't need to go up and ask him if he has a wife.
No, you don't.
I know he's unmarried because that's literally what the word bachelor means.
Correct. It is logically necessarily true. You cannot deny it without sounding completely crazy. But, and this is the crucial part, it is empty.
Empty. How is it empty?
It tells you absolutely nothing new about the real world.
Oh.
It's just a definition. It's a tautology. You
Yeah.
haven't learned a new fact about the universe. You've just clarified a dictionary word.
Okay, I see. It's safe, it's perfectly true, but it's boring.
Yes.
So what's the opposite of that?
A synthetic statement. This is where the predicate actually adds something new to the subject. It synthesizes new information.
Like what?
For example, the bachelor is miserable.
Ouch! Unlucky bachelor.
Or, bachelor is 6 feet tall. The point is, being miserable or being tall isn't hidden inside the basic definition of the word bachelor.
Right.
You can't figure that out just by sitting in your armchair thinking about the concept of bachelorhood. You have to synthesize, combine the concept with a brand new observable fact.
Got it. So analytic is true by definition. Synthetic is actually informative. It gives me new data. But I guess it's risky
Very risky.
because I could be wrong. Maybe the bachelor is actually super happy.
Exactly. It's contingent on the facts. Now let's look at the second pair of terms. This pair isn't about the words, it's about where we get the knowledge from.
Okay.
A priori and a posteriori.
I actually remember this vaguely from high school Latin. A posteriori means from the latter, right? Or after the fact.
Right. This is knowledge that is entirely dependent on experience. You have to look at the world to know it.
So if I ask you, is it raining outside right now?
I can't just close my eyes and use pure logic to find the answer. I have to physically look out the window. That's a posteriori knowledge.
Okay, easy enough. And a priori is from the former, before the fact.
Knowledge independent of experience. Think of it kind of like a computer. A posteriori knowledge are the files you download from the internet.
Right.
You have to go out and get them. A priori knowledge is the operating system that comes pre-installed on the hard drive. It is there before you ever connect to the web.
And Kant adds a really strict rule here, doesn't he?
He does. For something to be truly a priori, it must be universal and necessary.
Meaning.
It has to be true everywhere,
Yeah.
all the time, with absolutely no exceptions.
Like math.
Exactly like math. 2 + 2 = 4.
I don't need to actually go count two apples and two oranges to verify that. It's true on Earth, it's true on Mars, it'll be true in a million years.
Precisely. So here is the giant puzzle that Kant puts together. We have synthetic a posteriori knowledge.
Okay, that's just normal facts. The sky is blue, the bachelor is tall, we learn it from experience.
Easy. And we have analytic a priori knowledge, logic, and definitions. Triangles have three sides. Bachelors are unmarried.
Also easy.
But the Holy Grail, the thing Kant is frantically hunting for to save philosophy from Hume, is synthetic a priori knowledge.
Wait, let's combine those terms carefully. Synthetic means it's telling me something totally new about the world. And a priori means I know it's universally true without ever checking the world.
You see the massive problem.
It sounds like a complete contradiction. How can I possibly know a brand new fact about the physical universe without actually looking at the physical universe? That sounds like actual magic.
That is the million-dollar question Kant asks.
Huh.
How are synthetic a priori propositions possible? Because he firmly believes they are possible.
He does.
He thinks a statement like every effect has a cause is exactly this. It tells us something fundamental about the world. That's the synthetic part.
But we know it's true universally without needing to test every single atom in the cosmos. That's the a priori part.
Exactly. If he can prove that this kind of knowledge actually exists and is valid, he beats Hume. He proves we can have absolute certain knowledge about reality and science is saved.
So how does he do it? How does he perform this philosophical magic trick?
He does it by flipping the entire board game completely upside down. This is the famous Copernican Revolution we mentioned earlier.
This is the mind as a mold idea.
Right. Before Kant, the working theory was the spectator theory. The mind revolves around the object. The object is just out there, fully formed, and we sit here and passively watch it.
Like the camera analogy from earlier.
Exactly. But Kant says, no, the object revolves around the mind.
Okay.
The mind isn't passive at all. It actively contributes to the very structure of reality.
He uses the word transcendental here, right? Which sounds super mystical.
It does, but we have to be careful. Transcendental doesn't mean God out there in the clouds. And it doesn't mean God in everything, like Emerson or the Transcendentalists later on.
What does it mean for Kant, then?
In Kant's strict sense, transcendental refers to the inner resources of the human mind, the built-in conditions that make knowledge possible in the first place.
Okay, this is where Dr. Holmes uses that ice cube tray analogy in the lecture, which honestly, I found incredibly helpful to visualize all this jargon.
It's a brilliant image. So imagine that all the raw data coming in from your senses, all the light, the sound, the texture, is just water. It's totally fluid, shapeless, chaotic, messy.
Okay, so the raw world, nature, is just this formless soup.
Effectively, yes. But your mind is an ice cube tray. When that sensory water pours into your brain, the tray forces the water into a very specific structure.
It becomes cubes. Yeah. So if I'm just a normal person looking at an ice cube, I might think, wow, water just naturally exists in cubes. That's a fundamental law of nature.
But it doesn't. The water is totally formless. The tray makes it a cube. Kant says things like time, space, and causality are not out there in the water.
Wait, what?
They are the tray. They are the structure of your mind.
Okay, slow down. You're saying time isn't real. That sounds like something as incredibly stoned college student would say at 2 a.m.
Well, Kant is saying time isn't a physical thing you discover out in the world. Time is a nozzle in your mind that you force reality through so you can understand it.
That is wow.
Dr. Holmes uses the cookie press analogy too. The raw data is the dough. The star shape is your mind. You literally cannot help but make star-shaped cookies out of reality.
So when Hume said, we don't actually see causality in the billiard balls, he was actually right.
He was entirely right that it's not physically in the balls.
Mind blown.
But he was wrong to think it's just a psychological habit.
Yeah.
Kant says causality is the structure of the mind itself. It's hardwired into the hardware. Hmm. We literally cannot experience the world without filtering it through cause and effect.
It's like those glasses Dr. Holmes talks about. He says it's like shaving in the morning without his glasses on. Everything in the mirror is just a blur.
But when he puts them on, the world snaps into sharp focus.
Kant is basically saying we all wear these a priori glasses permanently glued to our faces from birth.
Yes, but with one massive crucial distinction. These aren't glasses that just fix our vision to show us the world as it really is.
Okay.
These are glasses that create the way the world appears. We see everything in 3D space, moving forward in time, following cause and effect, simply because that is how our mental glasses are built.
So going all the way back to this synthetic a priori question, how can I know every effect has a cause is true everywhere without checking the whole universe?
You can know it because you are the one supplying the causality.
Oh, because I know every cookie is going to be star-shaped because I'm the one holding the star-shaped press.
Exactly. That is a revolution.
That is actually genius. He saves science. We can be absolutely sure that physics works because our minds demand that reality works that way before we even experience it.
He saves science. He completely defeats Hume's skepticism.
Pies a pie.
There is a massive catch, a huge price tag attached to this revolution.
There is always a catch with philosophers. I think I see it coming, though. If I'm only ever seeing the cookie shape that my mind pressed the dough into, do I ever actually see the raw dough itself?
You do not. Yeah. Never.
Yeah.
And this leads to Kant's most famous distinction, the phenomena versus the noumena.
Ah, I've seen these terms in the reading. The Ding für mich and the Ding in sich. You've been practicing your German for this deep dive, haven't you?
A little bit, yeah. So phenomena is the thing for me, the Ding for me.
Eh.
It's the ice cube.
The world as it appears after my mind has processed it through the tray.
Exactly. And this is the only world that science can ever study.
And the noumena.
The Ding in sich. The thing in itself, reality as it actually exists independently before your mind touches it or shapes it, the raw, formless water.
And Kant says, what? We can just peek at it sometimes.
He says we can never, ever know it.
Never.
Not scientifically.
Yeah.
You simply cannot step outside your own mind to compare your mental picture with the real thing. You are permanently trapped inside your own ice cube tray.
That honestly, that feels like a huge letdown. I feel a bit cheated. I thought his whole mission was trying to save metaphysics.
Right.
But if we can't know the thing in itself, then we can't know God. We can't know the soul, because those things aren't sensory data that fit into an ice cube tray.
You've hit the exact nail on the head.
Okay.
Kant admits that dogmatic metaphysics, the kind Descartes and those guys did, trying to prove God with pure logic is completely impossible. You cannot apply your mental cookie cutters to things that aren't dough. God isn't sensory data. The universe as a whole isn't sensory data.
So he saved science, but he accidentally killed God in the process.
Well, he fired the metaphysicians from the science department, let's say. But then, and this is his next big move, he turned around and hired them back in the ethics department.
Okay, you have to explain that pivot. Because if we mathematically can't know God exists, how is religion or morality still in the picture for him?
Kant famously wrote in the preface to the second edition that he had to, and I quote, do away with knowledge to make room for belief.
Do away with knowledge to make room for belief. That is a really powerful line. What does it actually mean in practice?
He separates the mind into different faculties. So the critique of pure reason, everything we've been discussing about science and phenomena that says we can't scientifically know God.
Right.
But his second major book, The Critique of Practical Reason, deals entirely with morality and ethics, how we act. Kant argues that even though we can't scientifically prove we have free will, or that there is a God, or an afterlife, we effectively have to assume they exist to make any sense of our lives.
Because if there's no free will, morality is just a joke. I can't be held responsible for my actions if I'm just a biological robot following a physical physics program.
Exactly. And if there is no God or no afterlife, then there is ultimately no justice in the universe. Bad people get away with terrible things. Good people suffer immensely.
It makes the whole concept of moral duty feel completely pointless.
Right. But Kant says our internal sense of moral duty that we ought to do the right thing is so overwhelmingly strong, so undeniable, that it actively demands we assume these things exist.
So we postulate them. We assume them because we practically have to function as good humans.
Yes. We cannot find God with a telescope. That's pure reason, and it fails. But we find God through our conscience. That is practical reason.
Wow. He basically builds a massive, impenetrable firewall between science and faith so they can stop attacking each other.
It is genuinely one of the most impressive, comprehensive systems in human thought. He explains why math works, why science works, and why morality feels so intensely real, all just by analyzing the internal software of the human brain.
It's brilliant. It really is. But, and there's always, it leaves us with a really lingering question. And this is where Dr. Holmes's notes took a super fascinating turn right at the very end.
Ah, the Max Weber point.
Yeah. So Kant firmly thought these mental glasses, this ice cube tray we all have, was totally universal, biological.
He thought it was hardwired into the human species as a whole. Every single human has the exact same tray.
Right. But later philosophers, specifically sociologists like Max Weber, they looked at this and asked a really disturbing question. What if the tray isn't biological?
What if it's cultural?
Yes. What if my specific language, my history, my upbringing changes the actual shape of the nozzle in my mind?
If that's true, then we aren't just seeing the world through universal human glasses. We are seeing it through 21st century Western glasses.
Exactly. And someone from a totally different culture or a different time period might literally be wearing Eastern glasses or ancient glasses.
Which means we aren't just politely disagreeing about opinions or politics. We might be living in fundamentally different realities because our mental ice cube trays have entirely different shapes.
It implies that all truth might just be relative to the specific lens you happen to be wearing.
And that is a very dark rabbit hole that modern philosophy is honestly still trying to climb out of today.
So for everyone listening, that is the thought we want to leave you with today as you go about your week. How much of your reality, the things you think are absolute facts, is actually out there in the world?
And how much is just the shape of your own personal cookie cutter?
And if you met someone with a totally different set of lenses, could you even explain your world to them?
Heavy stuff to chew on.
Extremely heavy. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us. Go check your lenses, everyone. We'll see you next time.